Morning. Glad you are here with us. We are continuing in our study through the Gospel according to Moses, and we're looking primarily at Deuteronomy, kind of the second giving of the law. And, you know, when you think about what we've been called to, and you think about what it means for Jesus to call us into a relationship, one of the things he says is to count the cost and to really, okay, consider what it means. And so, you know, we had roughly 24 fifth through seventh graders that were in the class, and you know, we did these interviews this week, and not everybody. And I told them, I said, "Look, this I don't want this to be your parents' faith. Some of you may be in here to appease your parents, but I don't want you coming into a membership interview and claiming Christ when this isn't real, right?" And so, normally the students that you know, obviously want to become members, they come to the interview. But it was neat. The last couple that we had, when we really, I said, okay, give me your spiritual biography. Give me, you know, the first thing you remember about God. And when do you feel like God has moved into your heart and it's dropped from your head to your heart and you can say, this is no longer a religion. This is a relationship with Jesus Christ. And the last two interviews that we did, both these fellas said, you know what? I'm not there. And we talked about it, and they believe in God, and they can cognitively ascend to the truth. But, you know, these 12, there's a 12 and 4, or 13-year-old boy, or 11 and a 13-year-old boy said, you know what? I'm not there. It hasn't. So when we pressed them, we said, okay, you know, this is, no, it's not. And I was so proud of them. I was so like, yes, this is exactly what Jesus wants us to do. We have to think about what he's calling us to. Because the way that God is described in the book of Deuteronomy, and what probably in all the books of the Bible, the book of Deuteronomy, there's probably no single book of the Bible that is more, comprehensive in showing us how to live if we actually met God in Deuteronomy. Because it parses out, here's what we do. And God wanted us to really, really look at this. What does it mean for us to what? To be in covenant with him. To cut a covenant. Remember, anytime you had a relationship with God, you shed blood. You cut, right? You are blood with God. And so, we're going to start, and I'm just going to take a portion of Deuteronomy 4. I want you to think, where are you with God? What does it mean for you to covenant with him? Because I'm going to focus on just kind of three key words here in these verses, but it basically is the theme of Deuteronomy chapter 4. So we're going to start at verse 15, if you have your Bibles. You saw no form of any kind the day the Lord spoke to you at Horeb, out of the fire. That's the same as Sinai. Therefore, watch yourselves very carefully so that you do not become corrupt, and make for yourselves an idol, an image of any shape, whether formed like a man or a woman, or like any animal on earth, or any bird that flies in the air, or like any creature that moves along the ground, or any fish in the waters below. And when you look up to the sky and see the sun, the moon and the stars, all the heavenly array, do not be enticed into bowing down to them and worshiping things the Lord your God has apportioned to all the nations under heaven. But as for you, the Lord took you and brought you out of the iron smelting furnace, out of Egypt, to be the people of his inheritance, as you now are. The Lord was angry with me because of you. And he solemnly swore that I, Moses is talking, would not cross the Jordan and enter the good land the Lord your God is giving you as your inheritance. I will die in this land. I will not cross the Jordan. But you are about to cross over and take possession of that good land. Be careful not to forget the covenant of the Lord your God that he made with you. Do not make for yourselves an idol in the form of anything the Lord your God has forbidden. For, focus on this, the Lord your God is a consuming fire, a jealous God. Now we're going to jump actually to verse 33. Has any other people heard the voice of God speaking out of fire as you have and lived? Has any God ever tried to take for himself one nation out of another nation by testings, by signs and wonders, by war, by a mighty hand and an outstretched arm, or by great and awesome deeds like all the things the Lord your God did for you in Egypt before your very eyes? You were shown these things so that you might know that the Lord is God. Besides him, there is no other. From heaven, he made you hear his voice to discipline you. On earth, he showed you his great fire, and you heard his words from out of the fire. What do you see here? Deuteronomy talks about you and God as a covenant. What does it mean? I mean, we've talked about this before. What does it mean that you can only relate to God covenantally? What is it? Is it a contract? Here's what we know. We've already talked about this. No, it is far more personal and intimate than a contract. But is it simply a friendship? And we know what? Your covenant with God is much more binding, it's much more solemn, and it's much more accountable than simply saying, God is my friend. Of course he's your friend. I am a friend of God. But it's more than that. And so, to understand this chapter, I want to focus on three things: jealousy, idolatry, and the fire of God. Okay? Jealousy, the idols that we deal with, and the fire of God. Verse 24, it says that the Lord our God is jealous. It says this a number of times in the Bible. And if you are maybe reading this as for the first time, or you're a modern enlightened mind, and you come and read and say, oh, the Christian God is a jealous God, that might be a little off-putting to you. What, he's a jealous God? I mean, what do you associate with jealousy? I mean, I know for me, generally it would be okay, it's a bit of a synonym for envy. Like I'm envious, or I'm coveting, I'm breaking the Tenth Commandment by being jealous. You know, a number of men have said, anybody who says God is a jealous God, who in the world would want this God to be their God? But the problem is that's not what it's talking about. Because here's what we know about envy. It's self-absorbed. That's what it's about. It's angry at the person for having all that, and that's not what this word means. That's not what the jealousy used in the Bible. It's much more complex. It's actually in a really complex but very positive way. It's a beautiful term. It actually should usher us into more intimacy with God when we understand that your God, this personal God, is jealous of you. He feels jealous. He has jealous feelings and jealous thoughts when he watches you do life, when he watches me do life. Have you ever seen a parent, a father or a mother, or if you're a parent, have you ever seen maybe a son or a daughter, and you love them, begin to develop a pattern, maybe of lying? Maybe you see your son or your daughter develop a pattern of deception. And you can tell it's coming. And you begin to realize that. What are your initial thoughts when you experience that? Do you feel warm and toasty? No. But let me ask you, as a parent, do you feel indifferent? No way. You don't feel indifferent. When you see your son or your daughter, or maybe you're that, and you feel that from them, as a parent, here's what you know. You get angry, but the anger is complex. When you really sift through that, you're angry. Why? Because of your love. That's why you're angry. You're angry not in spite of your love, but you're angry because you love them. But you're more angry for them than you're actually angry at them. And so when God looks at you, he's not envious. Because envy and coveting, it's simple. What does envy do? Envy destroys love. We know that. When you're envious of someone, you do not love them. What do you want to do when you're envious of someone? You want to pound them, right? You want to hammer them. But that's not what jealousy in the Bible, or as God has described, is like. It's complex. You're angry because of your love. You're angry at the evil that's destroying the loved one and your relationship with them. So it's anger because of love, not so much at them, but it's for them. Do you have a concept for God being jealous of you? Jealous towards you. Why? Because he is angry. He is angry because he wants your attention. Think about a friend, maybe a close friend. It's more than just a friendship. And maybe you start a business together and you realize that he or she, you've been lifelong friends, you start a business together, and then he or she begins to start talking behind your back with another company. And then you have a conversation that you didn't see coming, and that person leaves. I mean, you thought this was more than a friendship. This was a vocational relationship, but your families were friends. You had done life together. At that moment, you find yourself hurt in deep, deep ways. What if you found that your spouse, right, was with somebody else? You would have an intense reaction, because if you don't, what does that say? If you don't have a reaction, it's very clear that love has gone out of the relationship. What if you had a God who was indifferent towards your actions and just shrugged you off and said, okay, do whatever you'd like? That's not the God that, when we look at jealousy, that's not the God that I want. Because here's what we know: God's anger isn't the opposite of love. What is the opposite of love? It's hate. Because what's the final form of hate? It's indifference. You hate somebody enough to when you won't even feel anything. Your heart has become completely apathetic. But we have a God who loves us. And he uses words like, I am jealous of anything that gets in the way. I will not be second. But the problem is, for us, it's what Morgan prayed already, is that none of us in this room have experienced true, true, perfect love. You haven't. We know you haven't because why? Because of the fall. Because every part of our life is tainted by the fall. Even the best relationships that you have are polluted by what? By selfishness. That's what we know. That's what the scriptures say. So you haven't experienced. And so when you think of jealousy, you think of it being tainted. It's always somewhat wrong, right? In us, we get angry at others when something goes wrong in that loved one. We get angry at them for the trouble they're causing us, or the humiliation they're causing us, or something like that. But what if there was a perfect lover? What if there was? What if there was someone who perfectly, selflessly, and sacrificially committed to the good of you? And when something went wrong in your life, nothing happened bad to that relationship except for that person felt jealous towards you. No, I'm missing it. No, I don't want this for them. I am angry at this situation. Why? And so when you think of God and you think of his love, how do you think God loves you? When you think of the goodness of God and the love of God, what comes up into your mind? Because this is probably the most important thing about you. This is probably the most important doctrine of your theology. Of your theology, the doctrines that are underneath theology. This is so huge. How you view the love and goodness of God. And this is a bit longer quote, but it's from C.S. Lewis, and I love this. He writes this, talking about us Christians, us maybe surface Christians. By the goodness of God, we mean nowadays almost exclusively his lovingness. And in this, we may be right. And by love, in this context, most of us mean kindness, the desire to see others than the self happy. Not happy in this way or in that, but just happy. What would really satisfy us would be a God who said of anything we happen to like doing, what doesn't matter so long as they are contented. We want, in fact, not so much a father in heaven as a grandfather in heaven, a senile benevolence who, as they say, like to see young people enjoying themselves, and whose plan for the universe was simply that it might be truly said at the end of each day, a good time was had by all. That'll hit you between the eyes. You asked for a loving God. You have one. The great spirit you so lightly invoked, the Lord of terrible aspect, is present. Here we go again. Not a senile benevolence that drowsily wishes you to be happy in your own way. Not the cold philanthropy of a conscientious magistrate, nor the care of a host who feels responsible for the comfort of his guest, but the consuming fire himself, the love that made the worlds, persistent as the artist's love for his work, and despotic as a man's love for a dog, provident and venerable as a father's love for a child, jealous, inexorable, exacting as love between the sexes. How this should be, I do not know. It passes reason to explain why any creatures, not to say creatures such as we, should have a value so prodigious in their Creator's eyes. Do you see God's love as a senile grandfather, or simply as a host that welcomes you and is kind of light and happy, or just as simply as a dutiful civil magistrate? That's what God is. And I love how C.S. Lewis, it's none of those things, man. God's love for you is a consuming fire. It's all of it. It's all of your life. And so some of us, we say, you know what? What do we really want? Because for some of us, you know what? I think if you're really honest, this love is too big for you. You didn't sign up for this type of love. You don't understand what it means to have a jealous, all-consuming fire as the one that is supposed to be at the center of your life. You know, that's why I love that they said no to membership. Because at some small level, they understood this isn't a small thing. This isn't just, hey, sign your name here and you're part of the club. No. What we talked about is next week, they're going to come up and take their first communion. They're going to walk up here and they're going to take the juice and the bread and they're going to think about the body that was ripped and the blood that was shed. And they're going to do it in front of you and say, is this really what I believe? It should be all consuming. Moses is there on the mountain. He's on Nebo and he's looking over the Jordan River saying, I'm never going to get there because God's holiness is greater than I am. And I have to swallow. I have to eat some humble pie. I've seen him do amazing things, but I'm not going to get over there. But your fathers maybe are about ready to pass away, or maybe they have, right? The whole generation in the desert, maybe it passed away. And it's this young new generation. And he is saying, please don't take this lightly. Please don't make this some worship seminar or some camp experience. This is your life now. Now go take the land and go beat the Philistines and the Canaanites and the Moabites and the Amalekites and do it in my name and take the battle of Jericho and do it in my name, because God's jealousy, right, comes from his perfect desire for your love. Do you believe that? Do you feel that? Because Moses is trying to exhort his people and say, please understand this. Because if you go over there, you will be crushed if you don't understand how great his love for you is. That if you don't understand who I am the perfect father, and you won't be right. I love the movie I Am Sam, because it's the story of Sean Penn plays this kind of disabled father who doesn't quite have a high IQ, but he loves his daughter passionately. And the court wants to take his daughter away. And I love, very simply, he says this: I worry if they take Lucy away from her father. I'm sorry, this was Michelle Pfeiffer, who was the judge, seeing the love that the father had. I'm worried if they take Lucy away from her father, they will take away an enormous piece of her. And I worry that she will spend the rest of her life trying to fill that hole. And that's what those that don't know the Lord, that don't know their creator, they do. They try to fill it up with anything. And that leads us to the next point. Anything that leads us away from the consuming, jealous fire of God is what is an idol. And when you think about idolatry, verse 16 all the way to 19, it basically said, don't worship an image of a man or a woman or anything, right? An animal, a bird, a fish. We know in the ancient Near East, they worshiped all kinds of God. They were pantheists, right? There were gods everywhere. And Moses makes a list of these things. And what do we know about these things? They're good. A man's not bad. A fish isn't bad. An animal's not bad. They're good things. Why? Because they're created by God. These are good things. And when God, verse 9, God has apportioned to all the nations under heaven. They are all a what? The sun, the moon, the stars are a gift to you. But when you bow down to something, when you bow down to one of them, what do? You take a good thing and you make it the ultimate thing. Anything created, including your spouse, including your kids, including your very job. Anything that is a good thing, but what good thing have you made or have I made into what? The ultimate thing. So whether it's your reputation, whether it's we're finding out some of our sons and daughters are getting in and having success, getting into some of these great schools, right? Some schools better than the others. Some schools that I went to, I feel very good about. Okay. It doesn't matter though. Whether it's career or money, whether it's a friendship, whether it's a reputation, whether it's your independence. Anything of this created world can get in the way. And that's what Moses knew. He watched it. He watched it in the desert when God would ultimately provide for them in so many ways. But anything that's more important to your happiness, to your joy, to your emotional desires, to your fulfillment, anything that's more important in the meaning of life than God, it's what? It is an idol. Because what do idols do? That's what they are, but what do they do? It says in verse 16, we know what? So that you do not become corrupt. It corrupts you. That's what it does. Don't worship an idol in verse 23, but what? Be in covenant with God. Here's what it's saying. You're either in covenant with God or you're in covenant, a binding relationship with what? With an idol. When you look at something and you say in your heart or your imagination, I need that. And I want to give you three little tests right now to see what might be there, right? To see what in your heart might be in the way. What might you look at and say, you know what? My happiness and joy is contingent on this next thing. Think about this. If a good thing in your life is threatened, if something good in your life right now is threatened, it's what? It's going to be really hard and you're going to be really worried. But what happens to you if an ultimate thing becomes threatened? What do we do? There's a difference between worry and what? If an ultimate thing is threatened, you melt down. And that's how you know. If something's threatened and you're a little nervous, okay. But when this is threatened, you begin to melt down. You're going to fly off the handle. You're going to be paralyzed. You're going to lie. You're going to do anything. And you're going to get caught, and then your life is going to blow up. And God says, do you know the difference between being worried and freaking out? What's being threatened right now, and you feel like, oh boy, I feel like I'd be on the verge of freaking out rather than just simply being concerned or worry. Because when you're in covenant with an idol, it drives you. Here's what we know. It enslaves you. You have to have it. If you start to lose it, you might lose it, you freak out. First question. Second question is this. What if something's not simply threatened, but if you lose a good thing in your life? Right? Because if you lose a good thing in your life, here's what we know. There's grief. We see it. There's a whole book on Lamentations, right? You grieve and you sorrow, and you should. But if you lose an ultimate thing, what happens? You lose meaning in life. It's when people say, you know what? All I care about is my reputation. The only thing I have is my reputation. And you know what? He did blow it. We know this gymnastics coach blew it in some horrible ways. But his whole identity was in what he was, who he was. And you know what? It was his ultimate thing. So you know what he did? He shot himself in the head. There was no further reason to live. You lose all meaning in life if you lose what? The ultimate thing. But if you lose something good, you grieve well, you grieve hard, but it's not ultimate. And so, do you know the difference between grieving something and being in absolute despair? Because what does this passage ask you? You have to know yourself. You know what John Calvin said in the beginning of the father of our Presbyterianism? He said, if you're going to know God first, you have to know you. You have to do self-introspection. You have to know what makes you tick, the things and blessings that you have, but also your weakness. And so when you have no meaning in life, you don't want to get up in the morning, you know, ultimately though, it's our fault. It is our fault. Because if God was the center of our lives, we can what? You can never lose that. This guy, if he would have understood the jealous heart of God and the unbelievably forgiving heart of God, he would have known, even in spite of the terrible acts he did to young girls, God's unconditional love is still his. And that's mind-blowing. Maybe that's maddening to some of us because we don't quite understand unconditional love, but that's how much God loves us. He did not understand this. And if he is the source of your meaning and if he is the source of your love, and you can never lose him, and it's in your heart, think, you can go through literally anything. That's beautiful. Last question. If someone comes between you and a good thing. If someone comes in between you and a good thing, what do you do to that person? Messes up that good thing. You get mad at them, right? You do. And forgiveness is really hard, but it comes. But if someone comes in between you and an ultimate thing, what do you not do? You can never forgive them because that was your thing. And some of us in this room, we have those people, and they've gotten in the way of what, maybe it's a family member, maybe it's a relationship, whatever it is, and you think to yourself, I can never forgive them. Well, what does that diagnose? It diagnoses that as an ultimate thing. Because we have to be able to forgive. It doesn't mean you shouldn't be angry and hurt and let a process happen, but it means that hardness in your heart, when you think, why is my heart unwilling to forgive that person? Maybe that person took your identity from you or what you thought you were. And they said, that's my ultimate. And you said, that's my ultimate thing. So I will never, ever forgive them. And maybe you have a list of people and God is saying, you can't. That's an idol. Kill it. Crush it. Break down every idol. And so God says, look, I can't. Have people, what? I can't have people worshiping idols. Because when you really think about God's love and his jealousy against that idol, whatever you placed up in front of him, he's so jealous of because it's in the way. And some of us think of sin as breaking the law of God. What if you stop thinking that way? And you thought of idolatry as not breaking the law of God, but what if you thought about sin as breaking the heart of God. Sin is breaking God's heart. Some of us, we can kind of distance ourselves from it or make it sound a little wooden. Like when I sin, it's just breaking God's law. But what if you thought you're breaking your grandmother's heart, right? And both my grandmothers were the closest thing to the Trinity that I knew. The softest hearts ever. And when I think of breaking, right, the closest, thing that I knew as a soft loving heart. If I think about God and I kind of think it sometimes through the lens of how much they loved me and they just wanted to feed me banana bread and banana splits and I loved them for it. They just wanted to watch me eat and they asked me all the time if I wanted more, which of course I said yes. But what if you thought of your sin as breaking God's heart and he's jealous of you? He's all consuming. Would that change the way you thought of him? Moses is trying to tell his people, look, when you go into this land, please, this is the way you're designed. And we know the next couple chapters, he gives the Ten Commandments all over again. This is God's heart. Here's what we're supposed to follow. Don't break his heart. Don't think of it as a law. Think of it as his heart, of his design for you. Man, tell me that's not more relational. Tell me you want to follow and press after him. We don't use the words obedience when we're in love with somebody, right? You don't wait to find out what the other person wants when you're in love with them. You'd investigate it. You figure out. You look for all nonverbals. You ask other people, what do they want? How do they live? Mom, tell me how she works. What is her favorite color? What's her favorite flower? What's her favorite movie? I want to know everything about her. It's not obedience. It's, hey, no, this is a relationship. And maybe some of us have lost this. And God wants you to see, look, idolatry is simply breaking my heart. How will we follow after him and destroy these idols? Last thing, and I want to make this quick. Whenever you hear God being a jealous God and talk about the face of idolatry, we see him being a consuming fire, right? Our God is a jealous God, a fire. And you think about Genesis 15, here comes Abraham. He appeared to Abraham, right? In a fire, to Moses in the burning bush. He appears to the people of Israel in the fire. We see that. Fire is a theme. And when you think about fire, I want you to think about it in a complex, more complex way. Because when you think about fire, isn't fire somewhat beautiful? I mean, we're going to have a bonfire. There's something, when you see a fire, you can find yourself just staring at it. That is amazing. It's kind of a miracle, and it's just burning, and it's mesmerizing, right? And it's attractive, and it brings what? Warmth. But on the other hand, what do we know about fire? It's completely dangerous, and it's completely scary. And you can't handle it in any old way, right? You have to have all kinds of care. Do you have a God like that? Do you have an incredibly beautiful God who, what, can move you to tears with his beauty? You can walk to the top. You can go to the beach, Clearwater Beach, and watch that sunset. And tears come down because it's probably the most beautiful sunset there is. Then you go to the top of, you know, Aspen Mountain and look over and you see his handiwork and think, oh my goodness, he is unbelievable. And many of us only have, you know, one side to God. Some of us have a side to God where we see him as this divine drill sergeant who wants just to discipline us and keep us at a distance and only wants to yell at us when we do something wrong. That he is this great lawgiver and he decrees for you. And if you're really good, he may bless you. But then when you think about that God, that's not a beautiful God. That's not the beautiful God that moves you to tears. It feels something different, like something different. Because there's a God who what? Who just looking at him gives you joy. But on the other hand, some of us have this view of God that, you know, we feel like God is all loving, right? And this God says, I have some suggestions for living, right? Because we don't want to call them commandments. They're just suggestions because commandments are too abrasive, right? But that God doesn't demand you in his word to obey, doesn't contradict your deepest desires. That God is not demanding, and that God is not scary to you. That God is not judging, and that God never, ever gets angry like this God. Therefore, that God is what? Not what we talked about. Because the real God is of fire, and he's beautiful, and he's dangerous. And who interacted with this God? Think back to the prophet, or forward now, to Isaiah. When he went into the temple, and what? His smoke filled the temple, and it was the fire of God, and Isaiah just about melted down, and he said this, "Woe is me, for I am undone." He was sure he was going to die, but he didn't. And Moses says in verse 32 here, look, you got near the fire of God, and God spoke to you out of the fire, and he loves you, and he's putting his love on you. This is the God that you can't really comprehend. And then what do? We do the whole 50-yard pass to the New Testament. And then God says, hey, here's what I look like in human form. And it's Jesus. And here's Jesus. And in Luke 9, what's happening? Jesus is walking through Samaria with his disciples on their way to Jerusalem. And they go to this village. And what happens? What does the village do? The village rejects them. So what do the disciples say? All right, you're the God of fire, right, Jesus? They rejected you. Hey, why don't you pull down some fire from heaven on this village that rejects you, right? That's part of fire, right? Your judgment. They were saying, we want God's jealous anger towards what? Towards the evil in this world that's destroying the world. And so we want you to come down. But here's what they didn't know. If he would have called the fire of God, what would have happened to the disciples? They would have burned as well. And Jesus says, he doesn't do that. What happened right before that in Luke 9? We realize that Jesus has his great transfiguration where he is kind of illuminated. And all of a sudden, who is to his side? It's Elijah. And what do we know about Elijah in fire? That Elijah is going against the prophets of Baal, these idolaters. And fire came down, right, on Mount Carmel, right down on these prophets and destroyed them. And then in 2 Kings 1, when the soldiers came for Elijah to arrest and kill him, the fire of God came down, right, and destroyed the soldiers. And the disciples are saying, you're greater than Elijah, Jesus. Why can't you call fire down and kill these people who are rejecting you? But here's what we know about Jesus. He's different than Elijah. Think about this. When the soldiers came for him to arrest him, did fire come down? There was no fire. What does he do to the soldier? Instead of fire coming down, he heals the soldier's ear that Peter cut off. I thought you're bringing the fire of judgment down. When the soldiers begin to nail him to the cross and start to pound the nails through his hands, what? And splinter his bones, there is no fire. He just says what? Father, forgive them. And the disciples are saying, where's the fire? Where's the fire of God? And then Jesus says in Luke 12, I'm going to have to bring fire on the earth. I'm going to have to undergo a baptism. And how crushed I am until it is completed. Here's the thing that Jesus was saying as it relates to fire. I have come to bring the fire of God's judgment, his anger against evil, and I brought this fire. And I am, you know, in other words, this, I'm going to be baptized with this. And we think about baptism, we think about John the Baptist, but that's not at all what this baptism was talking about. Jesus did not bring the fire down on the village. He did not bring it on the soldiers, and we are not consumed when we believe in Jesus Christ. Because why? Because he was thrown into the fiery furnace. Right? He was the one who took the heat for us. The anger of God. Because he was so mad at sin, he had to come down and die for us. But he was so in love with us, what? That he was glad to die for us. All of this points to Jesus and what he is for us. You have a jealous God who wants your love. And the wrath that comes down and his anger at sin came down on his very son instead of you. That's how much he loves you. So when he says, follow me, he is saying, follow my heart. I want you to come to Tampa, Florida, and I want you to be a particular people in the middle of a pandemic. And I want people to look at you and say, what are you doing? Well, how are you? Why are you living this way? And you say, it's because the God of the universe, who is as scary and as beautiful as fire, sent his only son so that I would only experience the beauty of it and not experience the judgment of it, and that I can live with him forever one day. And Moses is trying to say, this is your covenant God. Go into the land and live. So that's my question to you this morning. When you think of God being jealous, does that move you? Can you know yourself and pick out your idols? And when you think about the fire that comes from heaven, can you understand the beauty and the terror of that? And that that fire can change your life when you understand that Jesus took the fire. It can change your life from the inside out. So let me pray and ask God to move.